convenient time, and then again, we will hold the breaks to 15 minutes. I've worked closely with Senator Leahy on scheduling matters and all other matters, and this is the model that we used for the confirmation of Chief Justice Roberts. It is our intention to conclude the hearings this week, and as Senator Leahy and I worked out the arrangements to have a markup on Tuesday of January the 17th, subject to something extraordinary happening. Now let me yield to the distinguished ranking member, Senator Leahy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to hold up your opening statement or the others. I do appreciate people being here. The Roberts hearings showed for Chief Justice John Roberts, it will be real questions asked, I would hope. I would hope senators on both sides of the aisle would do that. I think it's important. We are talking about a position representing 295 million Americans. On the schedule, I will work with the senior senator from Pennsylvania, the chairman. I understand, as one of our leaders once said, getting senators to all move in order is like having bullfrogs in a wheelbarrow. But we'll continue to work with that. And I think the most important thing is we have a good, solid hearing this week. And, Mr. Chairman, you have been totally fair in your procedures for this, as always. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Senator Leahy. And now we begin the opening statements. No senator's vote, except for the declaration of war or the authorization for the use of force, is more important than the confirmation of a nominee for the Supreme Court for a lifetime appointment. Judge Alito comes to this proceeding with extensive experience as a government lawyer, as a prosecutor, and as a judge. He has written some 361 opinions. He has voted in more than 4,800 cases, and it is possible to select a few of his cases to place him at any and every position on the judicial spectrum. By selecting the right cases, he can look like a flaming liberal or he can look like an arch conservative. This hearing will give Judge Alito the full opportunity to address the concerns of 280 million Americans on probing questions which will be put to him by 18 senators representing their diverse constituencies. I have reserved my own nomination on this, my own vote on this nomination, until the hearing is concluded. I am committed as chairman to a full, fair, and dignified hearing. Hearings for a Supreme Court nominee should not have a political tilt for either Republicans or Democrats. They should be in substance and in perception for all Americans. There is no firmly established rule as to how much a nominee must say to be confirmed. While I personally consider it inappropriate to ask a nominee how he would vote on a specific matter likely to come before the court, senators may ask whatever they choose, and the nominee is similarly free to respond as he chooses. It has been my experience that the hearings are really, in effect, a subtle minuet, with the nominee answering as many questions as he thinks necessary in order to be confirmed. Last year, when President Bush had two vacancies to fill, there was concern expressed that there might be an ideological change in the court. The preliminary indications are, from Chief Justice Roberts' performance on the court and his Judiciary Committee testimony on modesty, stability, and not jolting the system, all suggest that he will not move the court in a different direction. If that holds true, Judge Alito, if confirmed, may not be the swing vote, regardless of what position Judge Alito takes on the political spectrum. Perhaps the dominant issue in these hearings is the widespread concern about Judge Alito's position on a woman's right to choose. This has risen in part because of a 1985 statement made by Judge Alito that the Constitution does not provide for the right to an abortion. It has risen in part because of his advocacy in the Solicitor General's office seeking to limit or overrule Roe, and from the dissenting portion of his opinion in Casey versus Planned Parenthood in the Third Circuit. This hearing will give Judge Alito the public forum to address the issue, as he has with senators in private meetings, that his personal views and prior advocacy will not determine his judicial decision, but instead he will weigh factors such as stare decisis, that is, what are the precedents, that he will weigh women's and men's, too, reliance on Roe, and he will consider, too, whether Roe is, quote, embedded in the culture of our nation. The history of the court is full of surprises on the issue. The major case upholding Roe was Casey versus Planned Parenthood, where the landmark opinion was written jointly by three justices, Justice O'Connor, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Souter. Before coming to the court, Justice Souter, Justice Kennedy, and Justice O'Connor had all expressed views against a woman's right to choose. David Souter, as Attorney General of New Hampshire, even opposed changing New Hampshire's law prohibiting abortion, even after the Supreme Court of the United States had declared it unconstitutional. At the time of Justice Souter's confirmation hearing, there was a Stop Souter rally by the National Organization for Women a few blocks where we currently are holding this hearing, displaying in red a banner, Stop Souter or Women Will Die. Stop Souter Rally and Mass Lobbying Day. Somewhat similar to this morning's press, where banners are paraded in front of the Supreme Court, Save Roe, and a brochure circulated again by Now, Save Women's Lives, Vote No on Alito. So the history of this issue has been one full of surprises. This hearing comes at a time of great national concern about the balance between civil rights and the President's national security authority. The President's constitutional powers as Commander-in-Chief to conduct electronic surveillance appear to conflict with what Congress has said in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This conflict involves very major considerations raised by Justice Jackson's historic concurrence in the Youngstown steel seizure cases, where Justice Jackson wrote, quote, when the President acts pursuant to an express or implied authorization of Congress, his authority is at its maximum, for it includes all that he possesses in his own right and all that Congress can delegate. When the President acts in absence of a congressional grant of authority, he can rely only upon his own independent powers. When the President takes measures incompatible with the express or implied will of Congress, his power is at its lowest ebb. And as Justice Jackson noted, quote, what is at stake is the equilibrium established in our constitutional system. Another major area of concern is congressional power. And in recent decisions, the Supreme Court of the United States has declared acts of Congress unconstitutional, really denigrating the role of Congress. In declaring unconstitutional legislation designed to protect women against violence, the Supreme Court did so, notwithstanding a voluminous record in support of that legislation, but because of Congress's, quote, method of reasoning. Rather insulting to suggest that there is some superior method of reasoning in the court. When the Supreme Court handled two cases recently on the Americans for Disability Act, they upheld the act as it applied to discrimination as to access and declared it unconstitutional as it applied to discrimination in employment. They did so by applying a test of what is called congruent and proportionate, which candidly stated no one can figure out. In dissent, Justice Scalia called it a flabby test where the court set itself up as the taskmaster to see if Congress had done its homework. And Justice Scalia said that it was an invitation to judicial arbitrariness by policy-driven decision-making. And this hearing, I know, will involve consideration as to Judge Alito's views on congressional power. There is reason to believe that our Senate confirmation hearings may be having an effect on Supreme Court nominees on their later judicial duties. Years after their hearings, Supreme Court justices talked to me about our dialogues at these hearings. This process has now evolved to a point where nominees meet most of the senators. In this process, nominees get an earful. While no promises are extracted, statements are made by nominees which may well influence their future decisions. Chief Justice Roberts, for example, will have a tough time giving a jolt to the system after preaching modesty and stability. There is, I think, a heavy sense of drama as these hearings begin. This is the quintessential example of separation of powers under our constitutional process. As the president nominates, the Senate confirms or rejects, and the successful nominee ascends to the bench. While it may be a bit presumptuous, I believe the framers, if they were here, would be proud and pleased to see how well their Constitution is being applied. My red light just went on, and I now yield to my distinguished colleague, Senator Leahy.
Thank you, Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont.
Judge and Mrs. Alito and the others. You know, the challenge, following up on what the chairman is saying, the challenge for Judge Alito in the course of these hearings is to demonstrate that he's going to protect the rights and liberties of all Americans, and in doing that, serve as an effective check on government overreaching. I've said that the president did not help his cause by withdrawing his earlier nomination of Harriet Myers in the face of criticism from a narrow faction of his own party who were concerned about how she might vote. Supreme Court nominations should not be conducted through a series of winks and nods designed to reassure a small faction of our population while leaving the American people in the dark. And no president, I think we'd all agree, no president should be allowed to pack the courts, and especially the Supreme Court, with nominees selected to enshrine presidential claims of government power. The checks and balances that should be provided by the courts, Congress, and the Constitution are too important to be sacrificed to a narrow partisan agenda. So this hearing is the opportunity for the American people to learn what Samuel Alito thinks about their fundamental constitutional rights, and whether he, you, Judge, will protect their liberty, their privacy, and their autonomy from government intrusion. The Supreme Court belongs to all Americans, not just to the person occupying the White House, and not just to a narrow faction of either political party, because the Supreme Court is our ultimate check and balance. Independence of the court and its members is crucial to our democracy and our way of life. And the Senate should never be allowed to be a rubber stamp, neither should the Supreme Court. So I will ask the judge to demonstrate his independence from the interests of the president appointing him or nominating him. This is a nomination to a lifetime seat on the nation's highest court. It's going to a seat that's often represented the decisive vote on constitutional issues. So we have to make an informed decision. That means knowing more about Samuel Alito's work in the government and knowing more about his views. I will, as the judge knows, ask about the disturbing memorandum he wrote to become a political appointee in the Meese Justice Department. In that, he professed concern with the fundamental principle of one person, one vote, a principle of the equality that's the bedrock of our laws. And this hearing is the only opportunity that the American people and their representatives have to consider the suitability of the nominee to serve as a final arbiter on the meaning of the Constitution and its laws. Has he demonstrated commitment to the fundamental rights of all Americans? Will he allow the government to intrude on Americans' personal privacy and freedoms? In a time when this administration seems intent on accumulating unchecked power, Judge Alito's views on executive power are especially important. It's important to know whether he would serve with judicial independence or as a surrogate for the president nominating him. And so this public conversation, this hearing room in the next few days, is extremely important. It's the people's constitution and the people's rights that we're all charged with protecting and preserving. In this hearing, we embark on the constitutional process, one that was designed to protect these rights and has served this country so very well for more than two centuries. I'm reminded of a photograph of Mr. Chairman that hangs in the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. Shows the first woman ever to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States, taking the oath of office in 1981. Now, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor serves as a model Supreme Court justice, widely recognized as a jurist with practical values and a sense of the consequences of the legal decisions being made by the Supreme Court. And I regret that some on the extreme right have been so critical of Justice O'Connor and have adamantly opposed the naming of a successor who shares her judicial philosophy and qualities. And their criticism actually reflects poorly upon them. It does nothing to tarnish the record of the first woman to serve as an associate justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. She's a justice whose graciousness and sense of duty fuels her continued service, even agreeing to serve more than 6 months after her retirement date. And I know both you and I commend her for that. The court that serves America should reflect America. Now, this nomination was an opportunity, of course, for the president to make a nomination based on diversity. He didn't, even though there's no dearth of highly qualified Hispanics and African Americans, other individuals who could well have served as unifying nominees while adding to diversity. But that, of course, is the president's choice, Judge, not yours. But I look forward to the time when the membership of the Supreme Court is more reflective of the country it serves. Now, as the Senate begins its consideration of President Bush's nominee, his third to this seat, to Justice O'Connor's seat, we do so mindful of her critical role in the Supreme Court. Her legacy is one of fairness. And when I decide how to vote, it's because I want to see that legacy preserved. Justice O'Connor has been a guardian of the protections the Constitution provides the American people. She's come to provide balance and a check on government intrusion into our personal privacy and freedoms. In the Hamdi decision, she rejected the Bush administration's claim they could indefinitely detain a United States citizen. She upheld the fundamental principle of judicial review over the exercise of government power. And she wrote, and this is one we should all remember, she wrote that even war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens. She held that even this president is not above the law. And, of course, no president, Democratic or Republican, no president is above the law, as neither are you, nor I, nor anyone in this room. Her judgment has also been critical in protecting our environmental rights. She joined in 5-4 majorities affirming reproductive freedom and religious freedom and the Voting Rights Act. Each of these cases, and I mention them because they make how important a single Supreme Court justice is. And it's crucial that we determine what kind of justice Samuel Alito would be if confirmed. And of course, Judge, my question would be, will you be an independent jurist? It is as the elected representatives of the American people, all the people, nearly 300 million people, that we in the Senate are charged with the responsibility to examine whether to entrust their precious rights and liberties to this nominee. The Constitution is their document. It guarantees their rights from the heavy hand of government intrusion and the individual liberties to freedom of speech, to religion, to equal treatment, to due process and to privacy. Actually, this hearing, this is their process. The federal judiciary is unlike the other branches of government. Once confirmed, a federal judge serves for life, and there's no court above the Supreme Court. So the American people deserve a Supreme Court justice who can demonstrate that he or she would not be beholden to the president, but only to the law. Last October, the president succumbed to partisan pressure from the extreme right of his party by withdrawing Harriet Myers. And by withdrawing her nomination and substituting this one, the president has allowed his choice to be vetoed by an extreme faction within his party before even a hearing or a vote. Frankly, that was an eye-opening experience to me. It gives the impression there are those who do not want an independent federal judiciary. They demand judges who guarantee the results that they want. And that's why the questions will be asked so specifically of you, Judge. The nomination is being considered against the backdrop of another revelation, that the president has, outside the law, been conducting secret and warrantless spying on Americans for more than 4 years. This is a time when the protections of Americans' liberties are directly at risk, as are the checks and balances that have served to constrain abuses of power for more than 200 years. The Supreme Court's relied upon by all of us to protect our fundamental rights. Now, I have not decided how I vote in this nomination, and like the chairman, I'll base my determination on the whole record at the conclusion of these hearings, just as I did with in connection with the nomination of John Roberts to be Chief Justice. At the conclusion of those hearings, I determined to vote for him. Stakes for the American people could not be higher. This critical moment, Senate Democrats serving on this committee will perform our constitutional advice and consent responsibility with heightened vigilance. But I'd urge all senators, Republicans, and Democrats, and independents to join with us in serious consideration. The appointment of the next Supreme Court justice must be made in the people's interests and in the nation's interests, not in the interests of any partisan faction. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Leahy. Senator Hatch.
Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah.
Judge Alito, your family members, friends, and others who are accompanying you. This hearing is part of an ongoing evaluation of Judge Samuel Alito's nomination to replace Justice Sandra Day O'Connor as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. It is remarkable that after a nearly record-long period without a Supreme Court vacancy, we are here considering a second nominee in less than 6 months. Mr. Chairman, let me first commend you for firmly and fairly handling these hearings. The timetable we are following reflects your efforts to accommodate all sides, and the 70 days since President Bush announced the nomination significantly exceeds the average for other Supreme Court nominees. The debate over this and other judicial nominations is a debate over the judiciary itself. It is a debate over how much power unelected judges should have in our system of government, how much control judges should have over a written constitution that belongs to the people. Ending up in the right place in this debate requires starting in the right place. The right place to start is the proper description of what judges are supposed to do, and the rest of the process should reflect this judicial job description. The process for evaluating Judge Alito's nomination began when President Bush announced it more than 2 months ago. It continued with Judge Alito's meetings with more than two-thirds of the senators and a vigorous debate in the media and among analysts, scholars, and activists. As the Senate completes the evaluation process, we must keep some very important principles in mind and follow a few basic rules. The first principle is that in this judicial selection process, the Senate and the President have different roles. Under the Constitution, the President, not the Senate, nominates and appoints judges. The Senate has a different role. We must give our advice about whether President Bush should actually appoint Judge Alito by giving or withholding our consent. Abiding by the Constitution's design and our own historical tradition requires that, after Judge Alito's nomination reaches the Senate floor, we vigorously debate it and then vote up or down. The second principle is that in our system of government, the judicial and legislative branches have different roles. As Chief Justice Roberts described it when he was before this committee last fall, judges are not politicians. Judges must decide cases, not champion causes. Judges must settle legal disputes, not pursue agendas. Judges must interpret and apply the law, not make the law. This principle that judges are not politicians lies at the very heart of the judicial job description. In addition to these two principles, a few basic rules should guide how we complete this confirmation process. First, we must remember that judicial nominees are constrained in what they may discuss and how they may discuss it. Like Chief Justice Roberts and others before him, Judge Alito is already a federal judge. He not only will be bound by the canons of judicial ethics as a Supreme Court justice, he is already bound by these canons as an appeals court judge. Because judges may not issue advisory opinions, judicial nominees may not do so either, especially on issues likely to come before the court. That rule has always been honored. Needless to say, those who will demand such advisory opinions in this hearing will do so precisely on those issues that are likely to come before the court. They have a right to ask those questions. But as the Washington Post editorialized just this morning, however, quote, he will not and should not tell Americans how he will vote on hotly contested issues, unquote. When Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg was before us in 1993, she said that her standard was to give no hints, no forecasts, no previews, and decline to answer dozens of questions. The second rule we should follow is to consider each part of Judge Alito's records on its own terms for what each part actually is. He wrote memos when he worked for the Justice Department. He has written judicial opinions while on the appeals court. He wrote answers to the questionnaire from this committee in 1990 and again last year. He has written articles and given speeches. He has joined certain groups, and each of these is different. Each of these must be considered in its own context, on its own terms, rather than squeezed, twisted, and distorted into something designed instead to support a preconceived position or serve a pre-planned agenda. The third rule we should follow is considering Judge Alito's entire record. Some interest groups focus on, some would say they obsess about, one recusal question. Or they cherry-pick from the thousands of cases in which Judge Alito participated and the hundreds of opinions he authored or joined. Or they look at the results but ignore the facts and the law in those cases. Judge Alito comes to us with a record that is long, broad, and deep. He deserves, and our constitutional duty requires, that we consider his entire record. Finally, and perhaps most important, we must apply a judicial rather than a political standard to the information before us. And we do have a lot of information. The record includes more than 360 opinions of all kinds, majority, concurring, and dissenting, written during his judicial tenure. We have more than 36,000 pages of additional material, including unpublished opinions, legal briefs, articles, speeches, and Department of Justice documents relating to his service in the Office of Legal Counsel and in the Solicitor General's office. We must apply a judicial, not a political, standard to this record. Asking a judicial nominee whose side you will be on in future cases is a political standard. Evaluating Judge Alito's record by asking those whose side he has been on in past cases is again a political standard. Scorecards are common in the political process, but they are inappropriate in the judicial process. The most important tools in the judicial confirmation process are not litmus paper and a calculator. Applying a proper judicial standard to Judge Alito's record means putting aside the scorecards and looking at how he does what judges are supposed to do, namely, settle legal disputes by applying already established law. A judicial standard means that a judicial decision can be entirely correct even when the result does not line up with our preferred political positions or cater to certain political interests. When he was here last fall, Chief Justice Roberts compared judges to umpires who apply rules they did not write and cannot change to the competition before them. We do not evaluate an umpire's performance based on which team won the game, but on how that umpire applied the rules inning after inning. We do not hire umpires by showing them the roster for the upcoming season and demanding to know which teams they will favor before those teams even take the field. Similarly, we should evaluate judges and judicial nominees based on the general process for applying the law to any legal disputes, not on the specific result in a particular case or dispute. The fact that Judge Alito is such a baseball fan gives me even more confidence that he knows the proper role of a judge. I know that there is a pitch battle going on outside the Senate with dueling press conferences, television ads, email, petition drives, and stacks of reports and press releases. The Senate can rise above that battle if we remember the proper role for the Senate and the proper role for judges. We can rise above that battle if we respect that judicial nominees are limited in what they may into what they may discuss. Take each part of Judge Alito's record on its own terms. Consider Judge Alito's entire record and apply a judicial rather than a political standard. Judge Alito, I know you. I've known you for a long time. You are a good man. You're an exceptional judge as well. I welcome you and your family to this committee, and I hope that the days ahead will reflect more light than heat, and we congratulate you that you're willing to go through this grueling process to represent your country on one of the three separated powers that means so much to all of us. And I'm grateful to personally know you as well as I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Hatch. Senator Kennedy.
Edward Kennedy,
Thank
Democrat
you,
of Massachusetts.
Mr. Chairman. Judge Alito, I join in welcoming you and your family to this committee. I appreciated the opportunity to visit with you in my office a few weeks ago, and I was particularly impressed by your personal family story of how you were encouraged to do well and contribute to your community. And I also applaud your dedication to public service throughout your lifetime. Supreme Court nominations are an occasion to pause and reflect on the values that make our nation strong, just, and fair. And we must determine whether a nominee has a demonstrated commitment to those basic values. Will a nominee embrace and uphold the essential meaning of the four words inscribed above the entrance of the Supreme Court building? Equal justice under law. Justice Lewis Powell spoke for all of us when he said, "Equal justice under law is perhaps the most inspiring idea of our society. It is one of the ends for which our entire legal system exists. As we have seen from Justice O'Connor's example, even one justice can profoundly alter the meaning of those words for our citizens. Even one justice can deeply affect the rights and liberties of the American people. Even one justice can advance or reverse the progress of our journey. So the question before us in these hearings is this: does Judge Alito's record hold true to the letter and the spirit of equal justice? Is he committed to the core values of our Constitution that are at the heart of our nation's progress? And can he truly be even-handed and fair in his decisions? In a way, Judge Alito has faced this issue before as a nominee to the Court of Appeals. I had the privilege of chairing his confirmations hearing in 1990. And at that time, he had practiced law for 14 years, but only represented one client, the United States government. And I asked whether he believed he could be impartial in deciding cases involving the government. And in that hearing, Judge Alito said on the record that the most important quality for a judge is open-mindedness to the arguments. And he promised the committee that he would make a very conscious effort to be absolutely impartial. We took him at his word and overwhelmingly confirmed him to the Third Court of Appeals. We now have the record of Judge Alito's 15 years on the bench and the benefit of some of his earlier writings that were not available 15 years ago, and I regret to say that the record troubles me deeply. In an era where the White House is abusing power, is excusing and authorizing torture – and is spying on American citizens. I find Judge Alito's support for an all-powerful executive branch to be genuinely troubling. Under the President's spying program, there are no checks and balances. There is no outside review of the legality of this brazen infringement on the civil rights and liberties of the American people. Undeterred by the public outcry, the President vows to continue spying on American citizens. Ultimately, the courts will make the final judgment whether the White House has gone too far. Independent and impartial judges must assess the proper balance between protecting our liberties and protecting our national security. I'm gravely concerned by Judge Alito's clear record of support for vast presidential authority unchecked by the other two branches of government. In decision after decision on the bench, he has excused abusive actions by the authorities that intrude on the personal privacy and freedoms of average Americans. And in his writings and speeches, he has supported a level of overreaching presidential power that, frankly, most Americans find disturbing and even frightening. In fact, it is extraordinary that each of the three individuals this president has nominated for the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Roberts, Harriet Myers, and now Judge Alito, has served not only as a lawyer for the executive branch, but has defended the most expansive view of presidential authority. Perhaps that is why this president nominated them. But as Justice O'Connor stated, even a state of war is not a blank check for a president to do whatever he wants. The Supreme Court must serve as an independent check on abuses by the executive branch and a protector of our liberties, not a cheerleader for an imperial presidency. There are other areas of concern. In an era when too many Americans are losing their jobs or working for less, trying to make ends meet. In close cases, Judge Alito has ruled the vast majority of the time against the claims of the individual citizens. He has acted instead in favor of government, large corporations, and other powerful interests. In a study by the well-respected expert Professor Cass Sunstein of the University of Chicago Law School, Judge Alito was found to rule against the individual in 84% of his dissents. To put it plainly, average Americans have had a hard time getting a fair shake in his courtroom. In an era when America is still too divided by race and riches, Judge Alito has not written one single opinion on the merits in favor of a person of color alleging race discrimination on the job. In 15 years on the bench, not one. And when I look at that record in light of the 1985 job application to the Reagan Justice Department, it's even more troubling. That document lays out an ideological agenda that highlights his pride in belonging to an alumni group at Princeton that opposed the admission of women and proposed to curb the admission of racial minorities. It proclaims his legal opinion that the Constitution does not protect the right of women to make their own reproductive decisions. It expresses outright hostility to the basic principle of one person, one vote, affirmed by the Supreme Court as essential to ensuring that all Americans have a voice in their government. This application was not a youthful indiscretion. It was a document prepared by a mature 35-year-old professional. Finally, many of us are concerned about conflicting statements that Judge Alito has made in response to questions from this committee and others. As Chairman Spector has stated, this confirmation largely depends on the credibility of Judge Alito's statements to us, and we have questions. When asked about the ideological statements and specific legal opinions in his 1985 application, Judge Alito has dismissed those statements as just applying for a job. When he was before this committee in 1990 applying for a job to the circuit, He promised under oath that he would recuse himself from cases involving Vanguard, the mutual fund company in which he had most of his investments. But as a judge, he participated in a Vanguard case anyway and has offered many conflicting reasons to explain why he broke his word. We need to get to the bottom of this matter to assure ourselves that what Judge Alito says in these hearings will not be just words, but pledges that guide him in the future if he is confirmed. Judges are appointed by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, and it is our duty to ask questions on great issues that matter to the American people and to speak for them. Many Republican senators certainly demanded answers from Harriet Myers. We should expect no less from Judge Alito. There is no time for a double standard. If confirmed, Judge Alito could serve on the court for a generation or more, and the decisions he will make as justice will have a direct impact on the lives and liberties of our children, our grandchildren, and even our great-grandchildren. We have only one chance to get it right and a solemn obligation to do so. So, Judge Alito, I have serious questions to ask. I congratulate you on your nomination, and I look forward to your answers in these hearings.
Thank you, Senator Kennedy. Senator Grassley.
Charles Grassley is a Republican from Iowa.
View of Judge Alito. And I think the record will sustain my view. But first, Judge Alito, I welcome you and your proud family to the committee, and congratulations on your nomination. I first want to remind all Americans who might be listening that the Senate has a very important responsibility to confirm only well-qualified individuals who will faithfully interpret the law and the Constitution. Confirmation should be limited to those individuals who will be fair, unbiased, devoted to addressing the facts and the law before them without imposing their own values and political beliefs when deciding cases. Nominees shouldn't be expected to pre-commit to ruling on certain issues in a certain way, nor should senators ask nominees to pledge to rule on cases in a particular way. So if we fulfill our responsibility to the Constitution, the Supreme Court will be filled with superior legal minds who will pursue the one agenda that our founding fathers intended in writing the Constitution: justice rather than political or personal goals. The Supreme Court will then consist of individuals who meticulously apply the law and the Constitution regardless of whether the results they reach are popular or not. If we do our job right, the Supreme Court won't be made up of men and women who are on the side of the little guy or the big guy. Rather, the Supreme Court will be made up of men and women who are on the side of the law and the Constitution. From all accounts, Judge Alito has an impressive and extensive legal and judicial record, certainly one worthy of someone on the Supreme Court. Judge Alito excelled at top-notch schools, member of law review, clerk for the federal judge. He also held important positions at the Department of Justice Office Legal Counsel, Solicitor General's Office, and was U.S. Attorney for New Jersey before being appointed to the Third Circuit. I want to remind the American people, this nominee, Judge Alito, has been confirmed unanimously by the United States Senate, not once, but twice. This is a tremendous record of accomplishment in public service, equal to any Supreme Court nominee that I've considered in 25 years I've been on this committee. Not only that, Judge Alito has a reputation for being an exceptional and honest judge devoted to the rule of law, as well as being a man of integrity. Judge Alito enjoys the support and respect of people who work with him, practice with him, and therefore know him best. Example: 54 of Judge Alito's law clerks, Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike, signed a letter to the committee that stated, quote, We collectively were involved in thousands of cases, and it never once appeared to us that Judge Alito has prejudged a case or ruled based on political ideology. Continuing to quote, it is our uniform experience that Judge Alito was guided by his profound respect for the Constitution and the limited role of the judicial branch. Those 54 opinions say a lot about Judge Alito and his approach to judicial function. Like Chief Justice Roberts, it appears that Judge Alito tries to act like an umpire, calling the balls and strikes, rather than advocating a particular outcome. I'm also impressed with the very complimentary things that some lawyers have had to say about Judge Alito in the Lawyer's Evaluation section of the Almanac of Federal Judiciary. With respect to his legal ability, lawyers praised him, saying that Judge Alito was, quote, exceptional, quote, a brilliant judge, jurist. Another lawyer stated that to say that he is outstanding is to use understatement. He's the best judge on the circuit, maybe in the country, end of quote. With respect to his demeanor and temperament, lawyers found Judge Alito to be measured and judicial while on the bench. One lawyer commented that he is demanding but always courteous. He may occasionally, quoting, demonstrate a little bit of impatience with lawyers that aren't quite getting it. This can be directed at either side. It's just a sign that his mind is working more efficiently than yours. He's never discourteous, never abusive. Another lawyer said he is pleasant and courteous. Others commented about the impression that Judge Alito is a conservative judge, but certainly not out to impose his own personal agenda while on the bench. One lawyer commented that he, quote, is a conservative but reaches honest decisions, while another said, quote, by reputation he's known to be one of the more conservative judges on the court, but he is forthright and fair. He tries to decide cases in front of him in the right way, end quote. And the American Bar Association came out just last week with an evaluation of Judge Alito to be a justice. And they considered things like integrity, judgment, compassion, open-mindedness, and freedom from bias and commitment to equal justice under the law. The ABA once again found Judge Alito to be unanimously well qualified. This recommendation should have much weight for my colleagues on the other side, who have time and time again described the rating of the ABA as, quote, gold standard. Yet, some liberal interest groups have come out in full force and have attempted to paint Judge Alito to be an extremist and to be an activist. They've criticized a nominee who has, from what I see described by these lawyers and fellow judges, a reputation of being a restrained jurist committed to the rule of law and the Constitution. But that's what these outside the mainstream groups always do. They attack individuals who they believe won't implement their agenda before the Supreme Court. So Judge Alito should see criticism as a badge of honor worn by many past and present members of the court. Yet, I'm glad to see the public fully participate in this process, because this is the nature of our system of government. But I don't like to see facts twisted, untruths fabricated, to give the nominee a black eye even before he comes before our committee. So, Judge Alito, now you have that opportunity to set everyone straight on your record and your approach to deciding cases. These hearings are also an opportunity, a very good opportunity, to remind the public about the proper role of a judge in our system of checks and balances, limited government. Judges are required by our democratic system not to overstep their positions to become policymakers or super legislators. Supreme Court nominees should know without any doubt that their job is not to impose their own personal opinions of what is right and wrong, but to say what the law is rather than what they personally think the law ought to be. Supreme Court nominees should know that this exercise of judicial restraint is a key ingredient of being a good judge, as the Constitution constrains judges ever bit as much as it constrains we legislators, executives, and citizens in their actions. Moreover, Supreme Court nominees should be individuals who not only understand but truly respect the equal roles and responsibilities of different branches of government and our state governments. As Alexander Hamilton said in Federalist Number 78, quote, "The courts must decide the sense of the law, and if they should be disposed to exercise will instead of judgment, the consequences would be the substitution of their pleasure to that of the legislative body." Our framers expected the judicial branch to be the least dangerous branch of government. At our meeting in my office in November, I heard Judge Alito place emphasis on the limited role of the courts in our democratic society. He also reiterated this belief in a questionnaire he submitted to this committee. So I have some idea of how Judge Alito approaches the law and views the role of a judge. I am hopeful that his commitment to judicial restraint and to confining decisions to the law and the Constitution will shine through in this hearing, and I believe it will. And I'm hopeful that my colleagues will give Judge Alito a civil, a fair, and a dignified process, as well as an up or down vote. Because, as always, the Constitution sets the standard. The President nominates, the Senate deliberates, and then we are obligated to give our advice and consent in an up or down vote. Judge Alito, I congratulate you.
Thank you very much, Senator Grassley. Senator Biden.
Thank you, Mr.
Joseph
Chair.
Biden, Democrat of Delaware.
Judge, welcome. Mrs. Alito and your family, welcome. It's an incredible honor to be nominated by a President of the United States to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, and you to be congratulated. Judge, this may be one of the most significant or consequential nominations that the Senate will vote on since I've been here in the last three decades. I think history has delivered you, fortunately or unfortunately, to a moment where Supreme Court historians far into the future are going to look back on this nomination and make a judgment whether or not, with your nomination and if you are confirmed, whether the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court began to change from the consensus that existed the last 70 years, or whether it continued on the same path it has over the past six or seven decades. And that moment's right now. And lest we think it's kind of like we all go through this process, and I like the phrase minuet that the chairman used.